today on Family Talk.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Family Talk with your host, psychologist and author, Dr. James Dobson. I'm Dr. Meg Meeker, and our guest today is E.Z. Zwang. If you'd met him as a young man, you would have thought he was headed to jail or maybe an early grave. But God had a different plan for E.Z. God changed his life in a big way, and we're going to hear a part of that story today, aren't we, Doctor?
We are, and before we get to it, Dr. Meeker, you were fortunate to be with us today. You live in Traverse City, Michigan. I've said wherever in the world that is, northern Michigan.
It's not in the UP, but I drove home from Grand Rapids this morning, and we had a blizzard to beat all blizzards. And it was 60 degrees last week, but this is Michigan living.
And you were driving.
And I was driving. I just four-wheel drive all the way up 131, and that's just what you learn how to do. I had all my, you know, my snow gear in the back in case I got stuck. We saw a lot of cars off the highway, but, you know, I had a big old truck, and I just kept going.
Well, that storm was here yesterday. We had to close down, and I had to take Shirley to the doctor. She's had surgery on her foot. She's doing well, thank you.
Yes.
But the doctor wanted to see her yesterday, and I had to drive her because, I mean, it was dangerous.
Yeah.
And the wind was blowing so hard that we got out of the car and the wind nearly blew us down. I had a hat on that I had to go chasing off in the distance. So we're experiencing the same thing here in Colorado Springs. But it's good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be together.
We have worked together on a program in several weeks, and
I know.
It's always a pleasure.
I want
to begin the introduction of our guest, E.Z. Zwang, and he is with the National Bible Bee, and that's where I met him. And before I introduce him further, I want to say that Shirley and I had the opportunity last fall to attend the National Bible Bee.
Mm.
And I'm telling you, if you get a chance to do that, don't miss it. It's in San Antonio, Texas, and 4,000 kids around the United States compete with the ability to quote scripture.
Isn't that the way
it works is they give them a large section of scripture, large from my perspective, Shirley, and then they have the competition. And it comes down to the winner, and they can't really miss anything. It's amazing. I'm telling you, we sat on the front row and watched those kids. One of them who won the middle school championship has a speech impediment, and he did not miss a single word, and he won that division.
Good for him. Wow. And doesn't it make your heart just leap to see these young people who are being trained in Bible knowledge and getting those roots set down very deep? It's
and
so
nearly all
important.
Homeschooled, as you would imagine.
Yeah, yes.
E.Z., it's so good to have you here. I appreciate you being with us.
This is such a delight, Doctor, you know, especially after being a new believer and growing up and listening to you on the radio. Never did I think I'd be on this side of the microphone, and it is such a joy, and what a joy it was to be with you and Shirley at the Bible Bee. Like you, I was sitting there in awe with my jaw hitting the ground.
We sat together at dinner that night, twice, I believe.
Yeah, we had that private brunch, and then we sat together at dinner as well.
And I got so interested in your story and where you've been and how you got to this moment that I asked you to come be our guest and share some of those spiritual experiences and others.
And boy, was I surprised when you did that. You know, you kept asking me questions. I thought, boy, Dr. Dobson's asking a lot of questions. Then it dawned on me, this is what you've done for almost 40 years every day.
It is what I do, and I do want to know. No. So you attended Biola University, where my son Ryan graduated. You're a former associate pastor. You're now president of Living Waters Publications, which was founded by Ray Comfort, a friend of mine.
Right.
I really appreciate you joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Doctor. It's an honor.
Your background is really fascinating. You grew up in Lebanon,
right.
I believe.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, I was born in Lebanon in 1975, and believe it or not, that almost didn't happen. Back in that time, abortion on demand was illegal in Lebanon. So unlike the United States, a woman couldn't just walk into a clinic on a whim and have an abortion. But if she got special clearance from her primary physician, she was typically permitted to have one. So my mother had done that twice before I was born. And when she found out she was pregnant with me, she made a third attempt. But she recounted to me that as she sat in the doctor's office that day, he looked over at her and just simply said, "I'm not going to let you do this one."
Wow. Wonder why he picked you.
You know, I don't know. And when my mother shared that with me, I have to say, it was during a really special mother-son moment. It was a warm and joyous moment. And she looked at me as if to say, "I can't imagine my life without you." Mm-hmm. And it was in that context that she shared that with me. My mother was one of the most amazing women who've ever lived, compassionate, kind, loving. And so at that moment, she looked and was thinking, I can't imagine if I had done that. And you know, she intimated regret that she had even done that in the past, you know. And
so you didn't know that for a long time.
I didn't. No, I was about 9 or 10 when she shared that with me.
Wow. What was her reaction when the doctor said, "Sorry, I'm not going to do this"?
I think at the time she was probably shocked, you know, because he had allowed her to do it twice before. And so I think, you know, she realized she had no choice. I mean, if he didn't give her clearance, she couldn't do it. But I know that at the moment she shared that with me, she was looking back on that time, and that doctor was probably, in her heart and mind, the greatest friend she ever had.
You turned out to be a really tough kid.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were the ultimate strong-willed child, as I call it.
I was. I mean, I was quite the nightmare at the time. You know, being born in Lebanon when I was, 1975, I was born in September, but about 5 months before that, a huge civil war broke out in Lebanon that tore the country apart. And it was a real difficult time for my family. And, you know, my mother already had four children, my older brother, and then I had three sisters, and then I was the youngest of the five. And so times were tough there. Times were difficult.
Do you remember those early years of, you know, being in kindergarten and early grade school over there?
You know, I do have wartime? Brief memories because I was about 4 and a half when we ended up moving to the United States.
Okay.
So, you know, I just found myself one January morning being snatched out of bed, thrown into the back of a car and driven through the crazy streets of Beirut, Lebanon, only to then be thrown onto this giant tube called an airplane and flown to this new and strange land. And, you know, at that age, you don't have a say in anything. You know, you're kind of like glorified luggage. They just throw you here, there and everywhere.
You had uncles here
right
in the United States.
So one of my uncles had immigrated years before. He was younger, got educated here and started his career. And, you know, my father was more advanced in age. In fact, he was 65 when I was born. Believe it or not, this January, he just turned 105
really?
Years
wow.
old.
Yeah.
Is,
wow.
Yeah. I'm 83, doctor, but plastic surgery works wonders.
Yeah. No. 70s, 1975, to, yeah.
Right, right. Doesn't quite work. Yeah. But yeah, so, you know, my uncles saw that we were in a bad predicament. The war was tearing the country apart. We had had relatives that died. There were times when food was scarce. You'd have to line up, you know, to get bread. I mean, the war lasted till 1990.
And help me remember, Lebanon had a high percentage of Christians at that time.
Right. It was kind of split up between the Christian segment or the Maronite Catholic segment, which was the majority. And then you had, you know, your Muslim population, Sunni and Shiites. And then you had what were called the Druze. But yeah, it was unique in the Middle East in that the Christian population was the largest segment of the population.
Well, who was fighting who?
Well, it was a really complicated and multifaceted civil war. So it started in April of 75, and it began with the PLO, the People Liberation Organization of the Palestinians.
Yeah.
And then there were factions that were joining up with them. And that's kind of what sparked it. But then it just got, you know, militia after militia started to form, and it got really intricate and complicated. And so my uncle looked and said, "Hey, why don't you come here, bring your children, and give them a future?" And oh, what a joy it was to come to this new and at first strange land. And then to make it home, you know, I just kind of didn't know what to expect. I didn't speak a lick of English. You know, shortly after arriving, my parents put me into this very dangerous, hostile, and volatile environment called kindergarten.
Yeah.
and I'm like, how did I ever survive that, you know? Yeah. And I didn't speak a lick of English, and I'm trying to kind of make sense of everything. And I started off as a really wild child. Mm-hmm. You know, I think maybe some of it was a reaction to the new environment, to trying to sort of survive in a place where I'm trying to learn the language and I'm trying to adapt to the customs and cultures. But I became quite the troublemaker.
You have described some of the really rebellious things that you did, and they're really quite remarkable. We won't go into all of them, but you really did kind of take on the world. Mm. And I have made a habit of asking grown people who were strong-willed kids what they were mad at. Mm. What were you mad at? Why did you declare war with the world, really?
Yeah. I didn't waste any time in revealing my sinful nature, for sure, even at a young age. I mean, starting off very early, I started getting into fights at school. I started vandalizing cars in my neighborhood. I started impersonating a Cub Scout and going door-to-door collecting money for charity, which was my candy fund, of course. You know?
Which really is remarkable given your age. I mean, those are things that you'd hear of a 12-year-old doing, but you weren't 12.
No, I
you
wasn't.
You were very young.
Yeah.
You were 5 and 6 and 7 years old doing this.
Absolutely. And, you know,
and from a pediatric standpoint, if I saw that, I'd think, oh, my heavens. I mean, that's beyond the strong will. That's, you know, disturbed. Child, do you think you were angry at coming here? Were you like this in Lebanon before you came over? Or?
You know, I don't think so. I think the dynamic of being raised in a home where my parents didn't speak English, first of all. My father was almost 70 when we moved here. He was retired. My mom was a homemaker. And
he had a hard time with the language, too, didn't he?
Absolutely. You know, at that age and then not being in the workplace because he was retired. Yeah. So my parents never really learned English. And I think that there was a bit of resentfulness there in that they didn't participate in my life the way that I was watching other parents participate in the lives of my friends. But again, they were the most loving, kind-hearted parents. But it just kind of, I think, set me off. And I thank God for this one thing, though, because as bad as I turned out, my brother, my oldest brother, Frank, who was 14 years older than me, was kind of a steadying force in the home. Because my parents didn't understand the culture. They didn't know what was going on. They would often, you know, when I'd ask them, hey, can I go here? Can I do this? Well, ask your brother. You know, he knows what's going on. And in the Arab culture, the firstborn kind of has some seniority in the home amongst the siblings. So I think God, even at that time, without me realizing it, used him to kind of keep me in line to a degree, or I would have gone off the rails even worse than I did.
You were really not disciplined very well, though, were you?
Right. I think my parents tried the best that they could, but I don't think they had the sort of understanding that was needed to discipline a child like me. And so the discipline would kind of be hit and miss. It would be sometimes pacifying. Sometimes it would be intense. So it was not consistent, and it was not, you know, timely in the times when it was needed. And so,
and maybe they were tired too.
Yeah. I mean, it was difficult.
I would be. Yeah. Having a 5-year-old at 70, that would be hard.
Right. And as rambunctious as I was too, you know, I definitely gave them a hard time, and they tried their best. There's no question. And I have nothing but gratitude for their attempts. They loved me the best that they could. I think
you know who you remind me of? His name is Louis Zamperini.
Right. Yes.
He was a little hellion as a kid. He really was. He created such problems in the neighborhood that the people who lived around didn't want anything to do with him. Mm. And he went on and went to a great school, University of Southern California. Mm. And he happened to be a great runner. I think he went to the Olympics. And he fought in World War II and was in a prison camp. And there's a movie about him.
That's how I remember him now.
Called Unbroken. And he turned out to be a godly man.
Wow.
He had the temperament that you did.
Right. Well, you know, there did come a time in my young life when I was about 8 years old and I was growing up in the Catholic Church. I did something called my first Holy Communion. And I remember I decided at that time, I'm going to change my life. You know, I'm going to be a good kid. And And I'll tell you, there was a little reformation that took place in me. Stopped lying, stealing, cussing, you know, became mama's boy, became the teacher's pet. You know, my whole life of crime at 8 years old.
You just decided I'm done.
Yeah, I'm
right?
done. Yeah, and, you know, I reformed. I changed. But, you know, you can take a pig off a pig farm, get it reconstructive surgery, throw perfume and cologne on it, dress it up in clothes, put it at a gourmet dinner, but it's still a pig at heart, right? Once you let it go, it's going to go right back to the pig pen. And it only held for a while. And when I hit high school, that's when things really began to spiral out of control.
And shortly after, that's when you found the Lord Jesus Christ.
Right.
Explain that to us.
Well, you know, when I got into high school, my long list of do's and don'ts that I had created for myself to maintain my morality kind of faded to the background. I deceived the student body with my smooth and flattering speech and became my class president, actually. I always had this drive. Even when I was a kid, when I was in grade school, I used to make up stories that I was a part of a royal family that had to come to America because of a coup. And, you know, I was the little Arab king. You know, I want everyone to bow to me. So finally, my dream came true in high school. I became my class president. And once I sat on my throne, I just started wreaking havoc. And, you know, one fight after the other, causing trouble, vandalizing one of my classrooms when the teacher wasn't in there, threatening to kill one of my teachers. So by the end of that freshman year, when I was supposed to be the example to the entire freshman class, I end up getting kicked out of my first high school. So they sent me to a second high school my sophomore year. And that's where things really got worse. I was a rap artist back in that time, believe it or not. I had my artist-producer contract signed. And my producers produced some of the top artists in the industry at the time. And so here I was on my way to the big time. I had kind of this pride and arrogance. And so my first day on that campus, I connected with one of the kids that liked rap music. And said, he said, hey, come and hang out with us at lunch. So I did that. And one day turned into two into a week into a month. And one day we walked off campus to go to lunch. And they said, hey, we want you to become a part of our gang. These kids were part of a gang called the Crips. The Notorious Crips.
That's and bad news.
Real
That's
bad news. Bad, yeah. And so we walked off campus. And, you know, when you become a member of the Crips, you don't sign a contract. You know, you get initiated by having the gang members beat you up for you
Seriously.
To become a part of the gang.
They beat you up.
Yeah. So we walked down a alleyway that day at lunchtime, and they began to beat me to a pulp. And there I was, 15 years old, standing there, a mess, finding myself a member of one of the most notorious gangs in the United States.
So you stayed in the gang even after they beat you up.
Well, that's the initiation. So
well,
I knew.
I'm trying to wrap my mind around
right.
it. If somebody did that to me, I'd think, oh, I don't think this is for me.
Right.
Would you mind sharing what goes on a bit in the Crips? Or what, I assume this was in the 80s?
This would
late
have been
80s?
No. This would have actually been late. It was almost 1990, I think. 90 to 91 is the time that happened. And basically, you know, the Crips is a gang like any other gang, where you have people that want to belong, and they're driven together in a brotherhood of sorts, and it revolves around immorality and around crime and rebellion,
violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so. That's kind of what it was all about, and I became a part of that world. And boy, did my life just spiral out of control at that point. I found myself doing things I never thought I would do, saying things I never thought I would say. So it just all went out of control. And in the midst of all that, I was so distraught one day as one of my sisters began to sort of tell me, as the whole family was gathered together, that I was worthless, useless, wasn't going to amount to anything. And something in me just snapped. I remember I jumped up, lunged for the kitchen drawer, grabbed a knife, just began to stab violently at my wrist. I just wanted to die. And Aww. Here I was, you know, in light of my age and where I was, I had everything a kid my age could want. I had popularity. I had power through the gang. I had pleasure through different things. But I was lost. And I didn't understand that I was desperate for the God who created me and gave me life.
How'd you find him?
Well, a good friend of mine who grew up with me in our neighborhood one day came to me and said, hey, my parents invited me to this event called the Harvest Crusade. And they wanted me to ask you to come along. This was about a month before we were supposed to go. And so the day came about when we were supposed to go. And actually that morning, about 1 or 2 in the morning, he and I were parked off a street in our neighborhood, drunk out of our minds. And I remember I looked at him, I said, man, this is the greatest feeling I've ever had. I want to feel this way for the rest of my life. having no idea how the rest of my life was going to be transformed only hours later. So I get home, go to sleep, get up the next morning. This was August 15th, 1991, Thursday. And I went about my same sinful routine, and evening rolled around. I said, "Hey, Mom, I'm going to some Christian thing with my friend Bill tonight." She said, "You liar." And I thought, here I am for the first time in my life telling her the truth that she's not believing me. So we got in an argument, and I was a real angry young man. In fact, my bedroom wall was full of posters, and it wasn't because I loved the rap groups that were on there only, but it was because there were holes all over my walls. I'd get so angry, I'd often just punch holes in my bedroom wall. Mm. And so I started to punch the walls, and at that moment, my friend pulls up, and we get in his car and we start heading over to the crusade. And I was angry the whole way there. He said, "Man, what's going on?" I said, "Nothing." He goes, "What's happening?" I said, "Nothing."
This is the Greg Laurie
absolutely,
crusade.
With Pastor Greg Laurie, right? Yeah. And so we get there. And I remember I walked in and I was absolutely in shock. I looked around and I thought we were going to go to some church room and someone was going to get up and tell us little Bible stories. There were about 20,000 people there come to find that night. This was at the Pacific Amphitheater in Costa Mesa. And I walk in there and I was just blown away. And I remember sitting there, and as the music began to play, my heart started to soften. I remember looking at these people in the crowd. They were singing to God and raising their hands, and their faces were beaming with joy. And I remember looking and thinking, man, these people are acting as if though God is really here. You know? And little did I know that he was, and they knew it. And so when Greg Laurie got up and began to preach the gospel, it was as if though there was no one else in that entire amphitheater except the two of us. And everything that I had been thinking about in my own heart and mind, he began to touch on. You know, even though I was as bad as I was, oftentimes as people, I think it's natural we compare ourselves to others, right? The man smoking marijuana will point to the heroin addict. The heroin addict will say, "At least I'm not hurting anyone. He's a rapist." The rapist will point to the murderer. Even the murderer will say, "Well, at least I'm not like Hitler who murdered millions," right? When we compare ourselves to God's standard of righteousness, his holy law, you know, one lie makes you a liar. One thing stolen makes you a thief. Jesus said, if you look at a woman in lust after, you've committed adultery with her already in your heart. And so when I looked at God's standard, I realized my sinfulness and how much I deserved hell and how much I needed the salvation that Christ provided through his death and resurrection. And then Greg Laurie said something that I never heard, or if I heard it, I definitely never understood it. But he said, salvation is a free gift of God's grace. You can know today that you're saved. Because my whole life growing up, I tried to get my good to outweigh my bad. I tried to earn my own salvation. So when I heard salvation was a free gift, that God was truly willing to wipe away all the wicked sins that I'd ever committed and give me everlasting life, I remember the invitation was given and I just jumped up and ran forward. And I remember standing there with tears streaming down my face as I envisioned Christ hanging there on that cross, that crucifix that I saw in church week after week that meant nothing to me, suddenly made sense. And I understood that he bore my sins, that he was my substitute, that he was there to give me his righteousness. And I cried out in repentance and faith. And I tell you, Dr. Dobson and Dr. Meeker, I was instantly transformed into a new creation. It wasn't days later. It wasn't hours later or even minutes. It was instant.
Right away. And you were 16?
It was a month before I turned 16. My birthday is September 14th. This was August 15th.
Which I think is 91. Important for parents out there to hear. Because so many times we hear, you know, if you don't get your kids to love Christ before they're, you know, in high school, it's all over. But it isn't. I mean, here you were in the crypts.
Right.
And your parents had probably, I don't know if they'd given up on you, but I'm sure they were pretty distraught over your life. And then here you go.
You've been listening to an interview with E.Z. Zwane here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. What a remarkable testimony he has. It's hard to believe that such an angry young man would even go to a crusade event, much less give his life to Christ. Yet E.Z. Zwane did exactly that. And the change was instant and amazing. You don't want to miss the conclusion of this story when we find out more about how God continued to work in his life. Visit livingwaters.com if you want to discover more of EZ's story or find out more about how he's working to evangelize the world. You can also find that link on our website, drjamesdobson.org. You know, EZ's life is a great example of what happens when God brings peace into our chaos. If you long for lasting calm in a world that feels like it's spinning out of control, let me recommend one of our exclusive resources. Shirley Dobson has written a powerful book on the way prayer can lead you into a more intimate relationship with God. the only true source of peace. Certain Peace in Uncertain Times has a clear four-step approach to effective communication with God, and it's yours as our thank you gift for a donation of any amount this month. Call us at 877-732-6825 or follow the link on our website, drjamesdobson.org. I'm Jim Veldheis. Thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. And be sure to come back next time to hear the amazing conclusion of E.Z. Swain's testimony right here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. Family Talk is not associated with Focus on the Family.
When you become a parent, you find out quickly that kids don't come with instruction manuals. But you'll be glad to know that now they do, or at least with an iPhone app, free from Family Talk. This app personalizes resources around where you are in life. Whether you're a mom, dad, or looking for encouragement in your marriage, this app is for you. The app is packed with parenting and marriage advice from the expert on such matters, Dr. James Dobson. The app also allows you to set reminders to help you keep connected to God and your family. Go to the Family Talk website at drjamesdobson.org/app to download your free customized Family Talk app today. Again, that's drjamesdobson.org/app.